And good morning, everyone. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I'd like to thank you for joining the Public Health Data Systems Task Force. We have a couple guest presenters with us today, and I would like to thank them for joining us and participating in the discussion. All task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is always welcomed, either in the Zoom chat or during the public comment period that is scheduled at about 11:50 Eastern time this morning. I'm going to begin roll call of our task force members, so when I call your name, please indicate that you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Jillian Haney.
Here, good morning.
Arian Malik.
Good morning.
Rochelle Bolton.
Here.
Hans Bloomdijk.
Present.
Heather Cook Sinclair. Aaron Holt Coyne. Charles Cross. Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Joe Gibson.
Good morning.
Raj Gabarty. Jim Gerges. John Kansky.
Good morning.
Bryant Thomas Karras.
Hello, everyone.
I believe Stephen Lane is not able to join us today.
Jennifer Actually, no, Layden. I'm here, Mike.
Oh, great. Welcome, Stephen. Thank you. Jennifer Layden. Leslie Leonard.
Good morning.
Hung Lu, I know, is not able to join us today. Mark Morostica.
Good morning.
Aaron Meary. Alex Muggy.
Here.
Stephen Murphy.
Good morning.
Elia Oliveira. Jamie Pina.
Present. Good morning.
Abby Sears.
Good morning.
Vivian Singletary.
Good morning.
Bill Sutherland.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Turney. All right. Thank you so much, everyone. And now please join me in welcoming Arian and Jillian for their opening remarks.
Good morning. We have a pretty impactful topic today. As I think we experienced through the last 3 years, getting case information for case investigation has been one of the workflows that has required the most effort. Starting early on, was mostly accomplished through traditional means, filling out paper and digital equivalents of paper, sometimes faxing information back and forth. Case information is an essential part of the public health response, starts off the process, helps us with contact tracing, helps us with understanding the course and progress of disease, helps us with assembling research summaries as to the progress of an outbreak. And the ability to get prompt and timely case information out of EHRs is a capability that would greatly serve the next public health crisis. Fortunately, CDC had done preliminary work in putting together an ECR, electronic case reporting standard. Unfortunately, by the start of the outbreak, we were not in a deployed state, but we very quickly transitioned from having a draft standard to a partially deployed standard rolled out across multiple jurisdictions. And the jurisdictions that had access to ECR often reported that the electronic case information was coming into the local public health authority faster than, for example, the positive lab information indicating COVID. And so You know, I think we've got good indications that a broad nationwide deployment of electronic case tracking and case case reporting would be key to improving the public health information ecosystem. And so today we're going to talk about the F5 criteria. This is a set of criteria that right now doesn't have a set of standards and implementation guide, although use of ECR is an acceptable way of addressing the F5 criteria. And so we're going to get a view from the ground from the Department of Health perspective, as well as CDC perspective. And then we'll sort of canvas the participants here for experience on the provider side of adopting ECR. We'll go to our usual discussion. And then hopefully folks have been able to look at the tracking worksheet for topics. I did some work earlier this week in sort of assembling the aftermath of the immunization hearing that we heard last week and formulating a set of observations and in some cases draft recommendations. So we'll go in at the end of the session to the topics worksheet. That will be the course of today. Jillian, anything more you want to add before we start the panel?
Yeah, I just want to say that electronic case reporting is in its relative infancy as compared to some of the other public health data streams, such as syndromic surveillance and electronic laboratory reporting. And I think that's really important as we talk about what types of certifications may be appropriate. And the other thing to add, just in terms of its relative, you know, time in this arena, is that there has been public health really came together to determine what data elements would be appropriate for that initial case report, which turned into the electronic case report, and then has really established a centralized location for all of the data to flow and be routed. Laura Kahn is going to be speaking more to that. And then we also have Ann Kaiser here from Minnesota, who will be talking about their experience with ECR. So I think we can just go ahead and get right into the presentations. I'm hoping also that Steve Lane will be able to speak a little bit to his experience as a provider as well. So first up, we have Ann Kaiser from Minnesota. And please, Ann, take it away.
Thank you, Jillian. Just wanting to check, do you need me to pull my slides up for this? Perfect, thank you so much. So good morning, my name is Ann Kaiser. I work as an electronic onboarding coordinator at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I would like to speak about our process and where we're at. So Minnesota attested to ECR as an appropriate means for reporting cases in July of 2021. Presently, we're receiving for COVID-19 and some monkeypox ECRs from visits that are both in-state and in other states where the resident is Minnesota, because we are utilizing the AIMS platform, which is a centralized hub for routing ECRs to the appropriate public health agency. We have automated the consumption of ECRs into our surveillance system MEDS as of August of 2020. We are able to extract some patient and minimal visit information in order for the ECRs to route to the appropriate patient and disease in MEDS and attach a human readable EICR to the investigation. This allows for cases to show up in workflows and not hand enter in patient information, but does still require manual review of the EICR to extract clinically relevant information, essentially like an eFax. We receive data from 5 major healthcare organizations and 4 federally qualified healthcare organizations within the state of Minnesota. And we continue to work with 2 healthcare organizations for COVID-19 onboarding and 2 more for all reportable conditions. Next slide. So the extraction of relevant clinical information from an EICR is quite burdensome, as it requires creating individual lookup tables for each disease and our clinical information, which is why we haven't done additional extraction of relevant clinical information. So for example, for syphilis reporting, we would need to identify and extract treatment information relevant to syphilis, as well as if the patient was on PrEP, HIV testing information, and signs and symptoms related to neurosyphilis or ocular syphilis in order to meet the same case reporting requirements that we have on our paper syphilis reporting form. if the burdensome build out doesn't occur, public health program staff then still have to go into the case report and manually enter the information into the investigation in order to message relevant information to CDC. It is important that some information is not being utilized through national standards, such as lab data with LOINC codes, specifically where the tests are not public health notifiable, but are part of a case definition and definitions of a case per CDC case definition. For example, the RNA aminotransferase or ALT testing, which is done under liver function panels, can be more commonly done in-house and at smaller labs. ALT results are included in the case definition for hepatitis A, B, and C, but on their own aren't reportable to MDH. Routine tests like a liver function panel are less likely to have the national standards added into a system because the codes are not needed for public health reporting purposes. This is also true for specialized testing that gets sent out, as labs can utilize a general test order in their system for rare testing rather than building them out individually. When this is done, it is very difficult to add the appropriate test codes for their triggering for ECRs. Even if the lab findings do show up in an ECR, it then requires public health to mine and map local codes in order to extract appropriate information into our surveillance system. Next slide. So the recommendations that I would put forth would be to improve ECR would first be to include an ECR transmission standard into the regulations. For example, ELR will call out the usage of the HL7251 implementation specifications. The addition of the standards to follow also help public health in routing, extracting, and error handling on ECR messages. It is the blueprint for us to know where we can find relevant information to extract. The object IDs or OIDs are the unique facility ID that is used to identify facilities and systems sending ECR messages. Yet there isn't a registry or lookup for this available publicly. Many public health agencies do require a unique ID for facilities to register for promoting interoperability. For lab reporting, this is the CLIA. These IDs allow us to route messages during onboarding, as most public health agencies will route production messages to a test environment to ensure issues are resolved prior to putting the production data into their production system. Next, the downloading of the RCTC codes from the ESRD or trigger codes that are loaded into the EMR to identify encounters that are appropriate to report to public health do not have a timeline put in around how quickly they need to be implemented within the healthcare organization after an update is released. In reviewing ECRs submitted from July of 2022, some of the healthcare organizations submitting to MDH were still using RCTC codes from the previous summer. Lastly, there is a need for more direction or review on addressing codes and standards from feeder systems such as reference laboratories and how they integrate with EMRs in order to improve the national code usage. Next slide. And that's my contact information. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. I think we'll just hold for 1 second for questions. I just want to put a little bit of context into Anne's presentations in terms of how the public health investigations unfolds. You know, we hear the term electronic case report, but what does that actually mean? And that often is just the initial piece of information that gets reported to public health in terms of a suspect case that's based on a trigger code. They may actually not be a case yet. And so what public health then does is take that initial pieces, the initial pieces of information and look through and start an investigation to determine whether or not that individual requires investigation, and then gathers clinical information, risk information, and so on and so forth that may be in the EHR, may be held in notes, maybe we need to contact the actual case themselves to get the further information. And then from there, we'll actually synthesize all of that clinical information, that laboratory information that's coming from a variety of different spaces to determine whether or not that individual's information will meet the actual case definition that then determines reportability to CDC. So I just wanted to provide a little bit of context in terms of some of the things that Anne mentioned there. The other thing that I heard again is like, you know, again, the challenges of working with unstandardized codings and the need for timely implementation of trigger sets that needs to be of consideration. So I think I would like to turn it over to Laura right now so that she can provide the bigger context of ECR and the AIMS platform and RCKMS, and then we will start with questions. So Laura?
Great. Thank you, Jillian. Just checking audio. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Good morning, everyone. My name is Laura Kahn. I'm the ECR program lead at the CDC, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this morning. You can go to the next slide, please. So hospitals and healthcare providers reporting to public health using ECR within their EHR system became required as part of the public health and clinical data exchange measure under the CMS promoting interoperability rules this year in 2022. However, the original ECR certification criteria shown here dates back to 2015. These criteria lack the specificity of standards that are needed to be implemented to optimize connections with public health. The public health community has been and continues to advocate for more stringent standards-based criteria to support the needs of public health agencies to rapidly use this critical clinical data provided in electronic case reports. Next slide. Public health, and Jillian mentioned this, but public health has agreed upon a single interface for ECR data to be exchanged between healthcare and public health agencies, and a single standard has been published for reporting of all conditions and is being used nationwide. The way public health has come together for this is an enormous accomplishment. We now need ECR standards to be required as part of EHR certification. In addition to requiring the use of the standards, more consistent provision of the data must also be required to make it more easily consumed by public health systems. Next slide. The current version of the ECR standards are listed here and available on HL7 websites. I'll discuss these more in the next slide. Next slide. The very specific needs that including standards and ECR certification that will support are here. As we have seen just in the last 2.5 years, but is a well-known phenomenon to the public health community, supporting the need for public health to receive case reports for conditions and emerging outbreaks rapidly is key to public health actions. For ECR, this means that healthcare needs to electronically receive and rapidly consume the codes used to trigger these reports. For example, during COVID, both the diagnosis codes and laboratory tests being used evolved over the course of the pandemic. These updates to codes needed to be taken and used within an EHR in order to identify patients that needed to have a case report submitted to public health for action. The HL7 standard that meet these emergency needs is the Electronic Reporting and Surveillance Distribution, or ERSD, transaction that's in the FHIR ECR implementation guide. This was most recently used to rapidly add monkeypox to ECR, but routine updates to code sets like Lincoln's NOMED occur on a regular release schedule and must also be accommodated. After receiving ECR data from healthcare, public health agencies need to ingest the data into public health information systems. This makes the quality of the data coming from in these electronic documents extremely important. Historically, data from EHRs have been irregularly structured and oftentimes not coded, even when code systems exist for specific data types. This is an area where USCDI does not yet go far enough. Public health needs EHRs to regularly store and provide coded data, not just be capable of handling it within their internal systems. And while we sympathize that not all data coming into EHRs from outside sources may be coded, the data is only useful when it can be used, shared, and consistently interpreted by those that need it. For example, if lab results are not coded, identifying a bacterial culture result of salmonellosis stored only as text in the EHR could miss a report of this important foodborne illness not being sent to public health. Similarly, some conditions are reportable at the time of suspicion by a healthcare provider. For example, and if a order of a measles test is done. It's an early indication of a possible measles case. And if it's not coded, then the EHR cannot trigger and send this possible case report, thus delaying public health action. So certifying the use of the full electronic initial case report, or EICR, both for structure and for content, will support these needs. ECR was established to exchange information bidirectionally between healthcare and public health. The reportability response provides return information to healthcare, both to confirm that that reporting has occurred, but also allow public health the opportunity to give information back to the clinical personnel about the condition that was reported, such as treatment guidelines or potentially additional testing needs. This document also provides information to EHR system administrators in healthcare, such as indicating if they're using an outdated trigger set or if codes are in use that have been deprecated from code systems. So without a requirement for the use of these standards for both structure and content and ONC certification for ECR, it really takes a lot of work with EHR vendors to ensure that their products can provide data that is usable at the public health agency. The quality of the data from EHRs directly relates to the public health ability to process and use this data in their systems. Next slide, please. So while I've focused on the EHR certification so far, I know that this task force is also considering possible certification needs on the public health system side as well. As I shared earlier, and as shown here on the left-hand side, all states, DC, Puerto Rico, and 13 local public health agencies can receive electronic case reports. The ability for public health agencies to receive electronic case report data is not the barrier. In fact, at the start of COVID, less than half of these public health agencies could receive ECR data. And within just a few months, because of the hub and spoke architecture, this capability was available nationwide, and ECR reports were flowing for COVID-19 from a growing number of healthcare organizations. Today, we are at just over 15,200 healthcare facilities using ECR. And similar to what you heard in the discussion last week on immunization, the use of the data is where the real challenge lies. Data coming from different systems in different ways prevent public health from processing this data quickly and routinely. You can see on the right-hand side of the slide, the use of ECR data in systems at public health agencies is a work in progress, with just over half using ECR data in either test or production systems. While public health system infrastructures vary, they need the data from EHRs that they can consistently rely on and is of high quality in order to process them in a timely way and make the data available for public health action. We have seen all of these challenges and needs manifest in the COVID-19 pandemic. It's time to ensure that data specificity that is needed can be addressed by enhancing certification for ECR. I'd like to thank the task force and ONC for inviting me to share this with you today, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Laura. Our next speaker is going to be Stephen Lane. And before we do that, I received a question in the chat that I just would like to quickly address. The question was asking me to comment about the specificity within the trigger codes and how that is applied to actual case counts within each jurisdiction. And I think the trigger codes are, depending upon the disease, the trigger codes can are established to report a case as either a suspect based on a laboratory result or a probable or a confirmed case. And it really depends on the disease. So for example, for salmonellosis, you can have a confirmed case of salmonellosis with just a culture confirmed laboratory report. But if you have a different type of laboratory results that comes in, such as a PCR for salmonellosis, that might go in as probable, and you need additional clinical information about symptoms to be able to actually confirm that case report. And so that's why public health needs to get the additional clinical information from either the EHR or the actual case in order to fill out that information and actually confirm that case. I think in terms of how that really applies to whether or not we're getting the true counts of disease within the jurisdiction. I think it really depends on the disease. We know, for example, for like really high volume diseases that, you know, cases are going to be missed unless there are automated systems in place to report those to us. But for very, you know, smaller volume diseases that may have required immediate disease response, like meningococcal disease, we feel pretty confident that we're catching, you know, the majority of those. So I hope that addresses the question. And if not, I'm happy to continue in the discussion. I do want to hand the floor over to Stephen Lane, who's going to talk about his experience with ECR and from the provider perspective. So Steve, welcome. Steve, I'm not sure if you're speaking, but we can't hear you.
I don't think I see him on the...
Maybe he dropped.
...participant list.
It looks like he's here. Stephen Lane, I see his... See him up there.
He put in the chat, bummer, so I'm not sure why we... He's obviously here, but
he is here. Yeah.
Hear him.
He's going to try to call back.
So, Jillian, while we're waiting, just one follow up on the question you just asked too, and didn't delve into the architecture in my comments, but one of the beauties of this single interface is to handle the complexity in the intermediary of the reporting variation for healthcare. So the full architecture requires a two-step decision support process. The triggers is the first step. And then on the intermediary, there's a decision support component that applies the jurisdiction's specific reporting requirements. So each jurisdiction authors their reporting requirements into the decision support tool, and the data and the case reports are then compared to their rules, and those reports go to the appropriate public health agency. And that's a very important step, because you cannot use the RCTC alone. It is not specific enough to identify cases of report that meet a jurisdiction reporting rule. So those two steps have to occur in order to facilitate the appropriate reporting to public health agencies.
The other thing I want to just note is that the decision support tool also routes the case report to the appropriate agency automatically, which is critically important, I think, in terms of workflow. I think we have Steve back. So Steve, can you?
How about now? Can you hear me now?
We can. Take it away, please.
Oh, wonderful. So sorry. And thanks for the opportunity to speak. I you had asked me to prepare formal comments and slides, and my week just didn't support that, but I'm really glad to be here and to speak to this. And it was interesting, Jillian, you introduced this topic discussing that that ECR was kind of in its infancy, I think were the terms you used, which is striking to me, because I feel like we've been at this for years now, and we've made such tremendous progress. We at Sutter Health in Northern California were well aware of ECR under the Digital Bridge. In our region, there were some organizations that were already engaged with Digital Bridge at the onset of the pandemic. And when the pandemic hit, it became very clear that there was an opportunity to kind of pivot that effort to focus specifically on COVID-19 reporting. And literally within 2 weeks, I think it was, Laura, we were able to organize one of the major EHR vendors, a number of healthcare organizations with Laura and the team from APHL, and we were able to get a COVID-19 specific ECR up and running nearly overnight. I mean, literally our implementation at Sutter Health, I think, took us 3 days. And what we saw in the early pandemic was a real enthusiasm for people to get on board with that, engagement with the providers, with EHR vendors, with public health agencies across the country, and those maps that Laura showed of the states where you've got people reporting, where you've got public health jurisdictions receiving and ingesting the data are really a testament to the tremendous work that's gone into this. So, I mean, while this may be in its infancy compared to other things, it's just such a tremendous example of how quickly things can move in the health IT world. I think that there are great opportunities here to move this to the next level and really make it part of our established foundation for public health interoperability. And the prior speakers have spoken to that. I think it's critical that we support, incentivize, and eventually require public health jurisdictions to be able to access, ingest, and utilize this ECR data, and then to replace the manual reporting process that providers have been burdened with for so long. We in California, as I said, we got this up literally within a week. And we only, I think, 2 weeks ago, finally, our state has said to us that they are now actually ingesting the data into the state system, you know, two and a half years later. So really a remarkable timeline, because one of the biggest challenges for provider organizations who need to invest a certain amount of energy to get this up and running and to maintain it is that they're still burdened with manual reporting. So it's really not until you can alleviate that manual reporting requirement that you're going to really see the traction. So I think being able to really push towards requirements for this is going to be important. The other thing I think is, it's been mentioned, the benefit of including specific technical standards in EHR certification. Right now, EHR certification is rather lax about how this is to be done, simply that it is to be done. And the standards clearly exist. They've been battle tested. And I think we need to move forward on that as soon as possible. You know, as Laura mentioned with the reportability response, this is really a model for bidirectional exchange between clinicians and public health. The clinicians send in the EICR and they get back the reportability response almost instantaneously. And it's great for now, you know, it's simply an acknowledgement of receipt, but the opportunity that we have for this to carry much more valuable payload back to the providers, specifically around, you know, antibiograms, about follow-up recommendations, about further testing, queries for additional clinical data to support case investigation. I mean, we can make so much more of this now that it is in place across the country. This is also a tremendous model for customized interoperability. As we've heard, each condition and oftentimes each jurisdiction has its own requirements, and the ability to write these into rules at a central spot and then have everybody across the country benefit from that as the rules need to change is really a great model for how we can do, I think, a number of other pieces of public health exchange also. And then also, as Arian and I and others have discussed in prior work groups, there is an opportunity to streamline some of the data flows. I think that what we have is we've thrown some data requirements into ELR and ECR, and they kind of overlap at this point. And I think once we have ECR as a requirement with technical standards, required to send, required to receive, then we can really streamline and rationalize some of the other data flows so that we're not sending duplicative information through multiple streams. So I thank you for the opportunity to discuss this here. This has just been a great project to be involved in, and the team that's been working on it has done a tremendous job. We now just need to push it over the line so that everyone is on board and utilization is going to be required. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. I hope I didn't imply that not a tremendous amount of work hasn't been done in a short period of time. I was merely comparing it to some of the longevity and time that we've spent in getting electronic laboratory up and running and syndromic surveillance. So a tremendous amount of progress actually has been made. I think that, you know, as the data have started to flow, I think that, you know, one of the things that we're seeing is again, you know, the issues with data quality from the data that are coming from the EHRs and the need to really make sure that, you know, coding sets are being implemented in a timely way. And that I see a question from Les Leonard in the chat about whether or not, Steve, you could comment about how it is to maintain those trigger codes and reporting data in the CCD to send to public health. So perhaps you could address
that. I mean, again, we work with one of the larger EHR vendors, and all of that functionality has been automated. Basically, the vendor gets the updates for the trigger codes, and they just push that out to all of their customers who are sending the ECR. So there's no significant manual work on our part. And that's what I was talking about. That is the beauty of this centralized model, is that the rules come out, that determines the triggers, and the data simply flows. Our turnaround time for that is minutes. It really is a very light lift for us. So that's a great thing.
I think there. I did want to say
one other thing. Sorry, okay. Jillian. I didn't want to throw the Department of Public Health in California under the bus, because they, you know, now that they are actually, they had to do a system upgrade and get their act together. And now that they are receiving the data, my understanding is that they are working with a number of systems to check the data quality, to bring that data in. And what they've said to us is that now they are hoping that in the coming year, we're going to be able to transition from ECR for COVID-19 exclusively, COVID and orthopox, where we are today, to ECR for all conditions. So I'm really hopeful that by the end of next year, we'll be up and running with all conditions, as well as being able to stop our manual reporting.
I think there are definitely going to be some, there could be some lessons learned in terms of your timeline for implementation. I think that is not the rapid turnaround for deployment of updated and current coded sets for the trigger codes has not necessarily been the experience across the rest of the country. I see, Les, you have your hand up.
Yes, I do. I wanted to make a few comments. And first of all, I want to really thank all the people working hard in public health about their dedication to ECR and to the task at hand of getting the data to all of us at a national level. Now, I'm going to say some very hard things in response to this after acknowledging their great efforts and doing this, but I want to be very clear about it. One, let's be factual about the real problem here. The real problem is that public health as a whole, at a state level, cannot agree on definitions of what reportable cases are. And as a result of that, we have to have a unique authoring and a unique reporting data requirements for each state that are continually evolving. And the advantage of the ECR centralized architecture is that it supports that. But the problem is the existence of this to start with, that until the states can come up with a unified approach, a standard for notifiable conditions that works across the country, that we can rapidly add to at a national level when it's needed, that it is very specific, as specific as we need for case reporting. I think that this is a very difficult task. Let's put the responsibility, though. I want to push the responsibility back on public health, because public health continually calls for the health system to do more, but it cannot agree among itself as to what it needs and what its data needs are and how to move forward. And this is an even older problem than ECR, and that paving over the cow path of the disagreements across states is... it's possible. We can try to come up with a technical solution, but we haven't addressed the core problem. Secondly,
can I just interject in there, because I'm not quite sure I agree with you about that we can't agree on what the cases are. I mean, the CSDE establishes the criteria for establishing what those case definitions are in terms of what makes a probable and confirmed case, and that consists of very specific laboratory criteria, as well as very specific clinical information. The challenge is for public health to be able to identify that clinical criteria to support meeting the case definition, and that's often embedded in notes within EHR systems and is not easily extractable and readable.
So one standard then for reporting, let's start with that. One national standard for notifiable conditions and reporting. Appreciate all the CSTE's efforts to try to do this, but that clearly there's not one target there yet. Once you have one target and then a national routing system to the right place, seems like the job will be a lot easier. But on public health side is one target that all the states agree on and meets legal requirements. I'm sure that the intellectual effort by CTSE is super important, but really ECR's architecture is designed to support the diversity rather than eliminate it. And it's unnecessary diversity. As you say, you've already done all the work to prove that there's only one definition of this. Why do we have all this unnecessary diversity among states as to what actually has to be in a case report form? That's the place we need to start. Secondly, I'm going to continue on here because I have an important point to make about the architecture of ECR. It's wrong. As you said, that the issue is getting a notification of an event worth investigation. That's fantastic. We know how good ELR is about notifications. And whatever the trigger event is, that's fantastic. But after the trigger event, it's not about a static one-time pull from an EHR to go into a one-time transmission to public health. It's about giving public health the access to the EHR to investigate the case, as you lay out so well, Jillian. The point is that that we need to use standards to allow public health to investigate cases. That means querying via FHIR and expansion and ensuring that US CDI data are available and making bulk FHIR routinely available for public health for queries. If we focus on those things, then public health can ask for the data that they want from either HIEs or from health systems on a regular basis, and it can be seamless with all the other data requests that are present for population health and other things there. It doesn't have to be a unique channel for public health. The reason you want to do this is that cases, as you say, go from probable to certain, but it's not actually categorized, it's a probability. And you're going to want to use AI methods and data science to actually figure out which are the right cases rather than having a hard rule-based definition, which is some kind of weird AI from the 80s. Time to move forward on all this. We need to build back better rather than paving over the cow path, which we've already shown doesn't work very well in, you know, really severe national emergencies.
Thank you, Les. Bryant, I see your hand is up next.
So I both agree and disagree with Les. I think that there's a tremendous value in supporting state flexibility. Our health officers, state epidemiologists, and our governors have keen awareness of what's happening on the ground and need to be able to adjust as needed in a response, especially during an emergency. So, you know, having a locked in national standard case definition that doesn't allow state to any kind of state flexibility would have proven ineffective in our response to COVID-19. So I just want to remind folks that predetermination and standardization is absolutely great as a goal, but we need to allow for to go beyond that. But where I do agree with Les, I think that EICR was always the I in EICR is initial. It was never intended to be the end of the report or the end of the investigation. It's the initial component. And there's a hope that we would evolve and build in that capability to reach back to the electronic medical record systems to retrieve the missing data elements, or if it isn't something that can be queried via a data element, you know, full access to the record or a survey to the provider or patient themselves about what transpired. That isn't part of the whole ecosystem yet, but I think that's where we'll need to go next. In terms of, you know, our local experience, you know, Washington State has been receiving EICR since 2020. We got 140 facilities onboarded in the first year of the pandemic. We got 315 onboarded in the second year of the pandemic. It's slowed down now in 2022. We've only gotten 7 new facilities on this year. There's still a ton more to go. And I think what we may be seeing and what we may be hearing from on this committee are the low-hanging fruit, those capable institutions that have the resources that can do this work or have a really well, strong, supporting vendor that can pull this off. It's the rest of our clinical community that are going to be lagging. And I think we need to remember that for public health to have a true all-inclusive surveillance system that eliminates the need for reporting from our clinicians, we're going to need to bring along the remainder of those clinical parties.
Thank you, Brian. Aaron?
I'm going to start off, first of all, just with a little bit of floor setting, and then I actually have some substantive questions. As we started out our journey with this task force, I proposed, because this topic of public health local autonomy versus nationwide interoperability is an evergreen topic, and we could spiral on this topic. I really proposed the frame of making sure that we have a common nationwide floor and that we enable upward use to raise the ceiling in local jurisdictions, supported by the provider organizations that are in those jurisdictions. And so in this topic particularly, I'd really encourage us to think about low regret common floor, as I mentioned in comments, having the ability to push a standardized trigger-based case report to public health does not prevent public health from asking for more. It does not prevent public health from querying subsequently. It does not prevent organizations from pushing updated case reports. All it does is establish a common nationwide floor to receive triggers and push out initial case reports. And that feels like a set of capabilities that we can build upon to raise the national floor. But again, that's the framework that I'd have is, as we think about standard and certification criteria, rather than dream on perfection, let's just make sure that what we're doing is enabling a common floor. The substantive questions are about the limitations that were mentioned in terms of coding and maintaining of trigger conditions. Just to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, it feels like the coding issues are secondary, number one, to lab order sets and labs not being encoded via LOINC, lab results not being encoded via LOINC, that we get proprietary codes in some cases. That are getting in the way. The triggers could fire if only we got the standardized data, but we're not getting the standardized data that that enables the trigger hooks. Is that a correct statement?
I think that's fair to say. Laura, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think that's fair, Arian, and I think a lot of it is around the labs. Although I will tell you that we have interacted with some vendors that aren't using SNOMED codes and problem lists, for example, and things where we think they're basic coding that were established in certification prior that are not there now. So I think it's a lot in the lab space, but there are other coding set issues as well.
Got it. So cool. And then the second one is, and we heard this theme in immunizations, the need to make sure our certification criteria are inclusive of the ability to update terminology sets. And then I'm also hearing, and in the administrative networks, we call these operating rules. I'm hearing that we have underlying certification for standards and implementation guidance, but we don't have the operating rules, the SLAs, the latency of data refresh for code sets, et cetera, and that might be an important portion of establishing the nationwide interoperability flow. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, yes. I think that That's very fair, especially awesome. It's to support the emergency response use cases when there's something that needs to be pushed out there quickly and see that rapid uptake. We need to certify against that.
Cool. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Rochelle?
Yeah, thank you. I maybe just wanted to provide some thoughts about from another state about implementation and challenges we've had. We've been working on ECR in Utah since 2015. Our first implementation was prior to the EICR standard, but it was really just a pilot to see was this valuable? What data could we get out of it? So we've been looking at ECR for quite a while. And when I look at it, I kind of think of breaking it down into three pieces. One is just an initial notification. Is there a case that we need to know about? And we have, you relied on labs and lab reporting ELR in the past to really be that initial source. And with ECR, where we've really found a benefit is rapid testing that doesn't go through a lab. Diagnoses, so conditions that don't have routine diagnostic tests, chickenpox is one. And then syndromes, toxic shock syndrome, hemolytic uremic syndrome. So things where that clinical information really is the key piece to reporting. And so ECR has been fantastic with that. The other is that demographic information, right? To even be able to know how to contact a case or what state they live in. And then the harder one, which I think we've talked about, is all that clinical information that can give us either that full picture or to really begin to implement some sort of intervention in a timely way. And that's what we're still trying to figure out just because of the complexity and just the variability of the information needed across the different conditions. So kind of from our perspective, that's kind of where we are, the big challenges that we've seen. And as far as just consuming that data, but just being able to parse through and what to expect and what's realistic and what's good enough and how we need to change our processes on the public health side to take advantage of this opportunity. So lots of challenges, but we've also seen a lot of really significant benefits. And so just wanted to throw that out there that we have like in production, in real life, seen some really great things. And again, just grateful for our providers who have been engaged with us. So I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Rochelle. I think Utah's perspective is really important because you have long been engaged in this world and have a lot of, as you said, real world experience with moving this forward. So thank you for that. John?
Thanks. I want to make a comment that I think is cross-cutting across the whole discussion today, and it's the need to accommodate both the direct from EHR path and the via an HIE or HIN intermediary path that we can accomplish the same thing. And I certainly understand those who come to this task force with the perspective that we want national homogeneity, meaning every EHR and every provider conforming to the same standard and reporting consistently across the country. But I started with a short list of listening to people of a short list of challenges, and that list keeps getting longer. And just real quickly, I want to highlight some of the potential advantages of those places in the country where you're going to do better relying on an intermediary approach and acknowledging there are places in the country where a direct from EHR approach will work better. But we have, reducing burden on providers. We have hospital systems reaching out to the HIE organization that we operate, asking us if we can please do this for them. One of the drivers for that is lower cost because their EHR vendors are charging them for this capability, and they're asking us if we can do it instead. There's a danger in bypassing the health information exchanges because of the value, for example, public health, of having a statewide HIE able to have population-wide data. So bypassing them is bad. And then the things that have been highlighted by Ann Kaiser's presentation, and Laura raised some challenges. The HIE intermediaries are in a position to overcome some of the challenges like local coding, because we're recoding data to standards as it comes in real time. And then also some of the data quality challenges. I don't want to go on any longer, but I just want the theme to be mentioned, probably in every call, that we have to acknowledge that we can implement these standards and achieve these goals via intermediary or direct from EHR. Thank you.
Hey, Jillian, just a request that we go through the last two, the remaining two hands raised, and then transition over to the spreadsheet.
Sure. I just wanted to point out that Laura did mention that there is ECR flowing through several HIEs. So maybe Laura, you could speak more to John's comment in the chat. Hans?
Yes, thank you. I want to support particularly Brian and John's comments in two parts. One, refining a little bit more of John's comments, that there are not only two methods, there are in a way three methods, a couple of different methods. They should be all feasible, because depending on the context and trying to get that long tail that that Brian was talking about, they may be suitable for that as well to help address and solve that. So it can be embedded in the EHR. You can use a Firebase app approach. You can use an intermediary, but it's key to have the common standards of the knowledge that you can share to have access to it, the output of the report, and an accepted set of transport. Currently, we see when you use APHL, it's XDR and direct, but that there is a predictability of that and a small set, but that there's consistency there. And then whether the path is best in the EHR itself, using an app or using an intermediary, is then at that point in time more an appropriate decision for based on the context and what's available. So I think it really needs to be standards-based with that level of flexibility to approach that. Another aspect of it is that as we go through this and we look at what is being reported, as we are thinking about querying some of the comments back and forth, we have to be careful not to go too far to a query-only approach. It is a balanced approach where at the time something happens, there is a need to share that it happens, and information that's already known to be of interest to share that with public health. But there also needs to be that ability to get more information because that becomes of interest or was otherwise not known yet that it was of interest. So I think the work that Helios is doing in its optimization and align track, where it's looking at those kind of questions as well, case reporting sits very much smack in the middle of that. From our perspective, since that has the opportunity to get all that additional data as well at an appropriate time. So you have to not only look at case reporting and the querying for more, but you also have to start to look at lab reporting and syndromic surveillance and say, how does that all tie together? That at the time that there is a trigger of something of interest, with all the challenges around the coding and the granularity available, but in principle, that at the time of the triggering, case reporting is a substantial element and a key element to optimize and stream that, and then allow for lots of querying beyond.
Thank you. All good points. Arian, do we have time for one more comment, or shall I turn it over
to
you?
No, let's please do.
Okay, Steve?
Steve, Ike, we disambiguate the Stevens by calling Ike.
Thank you. This has been a very useful discussion in a lot of ways. I think, you know, going back to a little bit of the earlier comments, looking at the data quality pieces of consistency, it's not just about the trigger codes, although those are certainly important. It's really looking at data all the way through, as well as looking at what is satisfactory or how the different local health departments or state health departments are validating the data that's coming across, and how do we address that component from a quality standpoint, as well as having potentially standards across public health so that providers are not in a position of having to meet 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 different health departments' quality standards that potentially are in conflict.
Also a good point. I just want to remind everybody that all of the comments in the chat are recorded as well. So please get your thoughts down there where we may not have had time for a verbal comment. Excellent discussion today. I think I'm going to ruminate a little bit before some final remarks. So I'll turn it over to Arian to talk about the spreadsheet, I believe.
All right. Thank you. So if we can display the current version of the spreadsheet. All right. Some little monkey named Arian Malik has done a fair amount of update to the spreadsheet. So again, just as a review, we want to use, the discussion and deliberation that we have here. It would be very helpful to make sure that task force members go into the spreadsheet and update with observations and with draft recommendations wherever possible. Can we scroll down? I haven't looked since a couple of days ago to see whether anybody else has done any updates. Yeah, Hans is always on the case. So fantastic. What I'm going to suggest we do is fantastic. So this is great. Little stone soup in progress. So. What I'd like to do here is just establish a cadence of doing regular reviews of this material to see if we can get to a common set of recommendations, perhaps unify some of our comments into recommendations text. And then that'll serve us well as we go into crunch time to prepare recommendations. So maybe we can filter first to the immunization registry comments. And yeah, we'll just do it right now. Rather than do this on the fly, we'll just do it manually by scrolling down. The first one should not have been immunization registries. It should have been other. So apologize for that. If we go on to the next one. First comment was that we have certification standards for the content, but not for the transport. And that we have a well-established transport specification for immunization. First of all, just noting that there is a widely adopted immunization guide for immunization transport, and then making a recommendation that ONC coordinate with yada, yada, yada to establish certification criteria for transport. Second one is that right now there are, second one is that, and I need to get the actual error report text, but there is some variation in immunization reporting that's jurisdictional. Based on the ERA investigation, most of that was down to the need to track inventory, specific requirements for inventory, track jurisdictional variation in consent, and then sort of an increasing trend in local jurisdictions looking for a broader set for race and ethnicity. So I drafted that to two requirements. One is that we update the immunization implementation specification to better address how to handle specific variation in inventory tracking, better handle variation in consent, and then separately make a recommendation that we establish a common subset for race ethnicity tracking. Again, for the just to give everybody the lay of the land. In the EHR certification program, there is a minimum OMB subset, which is the standard OMB, very, very narrow race ethnicity subset. But the allowed code set is the full CDC code set. And so as long as you're using the CDC code set, the FinVADS code set, you should be able to capture more granular race ethnicity. And so the implementation specifications should already allow for the capture of more granular information. But we don't yet have a common, more granular than OMB, but chunkier than the full, pretty overwhelming CDC subset. Next one is that we currently have two certification criteria for immunization. ERA and HIMSS got together and created the IIP certification criteria, which is now listed as an alternate test method as opposed to the primary test method. And so feels like a pretty easy recommendation to align to the IIP test method as the standard certification criteria. We'll skip over the overarching, but go to Hans. So Hans, why don't you go through your comments?
Okay. So the comments that I included two sets of comments. The first line 7 through 11 are effectively taking the discussion from last week in the presentation and putting them into a observation recommendation format. So I don't think we need to go through that then perhaps right now, just so that's the context where that sits. Okay. The second set that you see in there that has Steve Agnes' name and myself to it, as many probably know, there has been a high-tech adopted standards task force working over the last couple of months to provide recommendations on certification, standards referenced in certification. So what you see in line 17 through 22, while those recommendations are about to be reviewed and finalized and with potential updates perhaps next week, already put in the pending high-tech approval notes related to the public health related standards. So in there, you'll see the rationales as to why to maintain or replace, phase out, replace a currently referenced standard with a upcoming or an already available version of that standard to advance that. So I determined to put that in because for this discussion on certification criteria, the discussion then also would be around potentially what kind of standards are available to make the advancement we're looking for.
So that's the general comment to make. Hans, when you say available, there are two flavors of available. One is included in the ISA, and the second is endorsed by the secretary through regulation.
So the statements that are made here are related to based on the standards that are currently in regulation or in ASHA, but particularly in regulation. And then the available new standards, new versions or other standards perhaps are ones that are either already referenced in ASVAB, so indirectly, or that they are listed in ISA, or that they are known to have been published. So it is the range of what's out there that has been worked on to advance these standards and implementation guides.
Gotcha. And for the rest of the task force members who may not be as intimately familiar, and I don't think anybody is intimately familiar with all this stuff as Hans is, except for folks at ONC, the lay of the land right now is that ONC names standards and implementation guidance in regulation. And then the current set is the 2015 criteria amended at some point. So the set of criteria that are named in regulation are fairly old at this point. There is some speculation that there'll be an update in regulation. And then ONC has established an SFAP, Standards Voluntary Advancement Process. And the theory there for the SFAP is that there is voluntary acceptance of upwardly compatible versions of standards over the floor that's established in regulation. And the intent there is to establish a more flexible means to update standards that is not keyed back to regulation. So as the SFAP works, the standard named in reg serves as the mandatory floor, and the SFAP standard is the ceiling that most organizations are updating to. And then at some point, ONC flips the switch on deprecating the older version of the standard that's named in regulation and goes to a later version of the standard named in regulation. So the back and forth that Hans and I were having is just related to the status of the relevant F criteria with respect to both the named in regulation standards, as well as the SFAP available standards. And then, you know, above SFAP, there is the ISA, the Interoperability Standards Advisory, which is a catalog of potential standards where it's useful to make that standard available for reference. And so functionally, the SFAP will draw from the ISA, and over time, certification will draw from the SFAP to sort of set to deprecate the older version of the floor. So hopefully that's clear, and more than happy to provide clarity, or perhaps we can have ONC provide some additional clarity for how that machinery works. But what I'm hearing you say, Hans, is that we need to make sure that machinery is revved to ensure that we have the latest versions of all these pieces.
Yeah, and depending on which one you look at, it's the recommendations are in the direction of there is a newer version. Looks like that is appropriate to do. There are ones that indicate that there might be a newer version out there, but is the community ready to start to adopt it, because it's work on a variety of sides of the equation. And then in the case of, for example, case reporting, not directly referenced as a standard today in regulation for EICR, it is being raised in two cases as a potential augmentation or alternative, a blend of lab reporting or syndromic surveillance, and better balancing it with what case reporting can do. So those are the contexts in which these recommendations are made to look at, if not, and then for this task force, perhaps more specifically recommend what the right direction is.
And this is Steve Einar. I want to add, you know, appreciate all of Hans's work on the task force and all of the work on the interoperability standards task force efforts, but also want to emphasize, particularly in the discussion in the report regarding public health related exchange standards, that there is an ongoing emphasis, especially because public health systems are not currently referenced or not currently certified. There's specific attention paid to ensuring that public health's needs are being met and that there's synergy between the standards that might be adopted for the existing regulations with public health needs, to ensure that public health data needs are met, both in terms of content and timeliness and of course quality as well. So the goal is to float all boats. There are just a lot of boats that we need to float simultaneously.
Yeah, and again, just to repeat from the preamble from the opener, that you know, as we contemplate certification criteria for public health data systems, we should be contemplating that those certification criteria come with appropriate means to update public health data systems. That, you know, it would sort of be it would be illogical and folly if we assume that there's no funding to update public health data systems and yet a requirement to certify to later standards. I think we know how that that adventure would work out in practice. Are there any other comments in the spreadsheet on immunization registry standards that we should that the task force members have made that we should be reviewing?
I've made a couple. I think I've made one on IIS and one overarching.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it necessarily has to be reviewed. I think it may have already been discussed.
Yeah, so Vivian, maybe you can look at the recommendation that I made above, because it really is intended to get at the variation in practice for interoperability, and maybe we can harmonize those two recommendations.
Yes, makes total sense to me.
Cool, thank you. Let's pick up on a couple of repeated comments that have come through. You know, Jamie and I both noted variation in collection of race and ethnicity data. Again, as I said, the way the machinery works right now is that the certification program and USCDI call for the collection of data to at least the OMB standard, which is the 5 race and ethnicity codes, including Hispanic and non-Hispanic Caucasian, there is a full CDC FinVADS list that is incredibly granular. So, you know, Jamie, just to respond to some of your comments, as USCDI advances, so part of the issue right now is that USCDI is still pinned to version 1. As we advance to version 2 and version 3, we're going to get the updates that we've done for example, SOGI data as a matter of course. The biggest issue right now is that we're still pinned to the OMB race ethnicity code set. It would be helpful to get a less granular than the full CDC list and more granular than OMB list in order to unify nationwide standards. Jillian, is CSTE doing anything here, or what's the lay of the land in terms of getting to, at least from the public health side, a minimally useful set to better track disease burden and surveillance?
What do you mean by for race and ethnicity specifically?
For race and ethnicity, yeah.
I am not aware. I don't know the answer to that question. I'll have to circle back.
And then Brent, if I recall, you've been working on creating more expansive code sets for race and ethnicity. Do I have that right?
Brian? I can try to speak for this because I've chatted with him about this.
Yeah.
Washington has passed regulation, I believe, that has expanded the required list of the list of what is included in their race and ethnicity data set.
Maybe Brian, if you're available, or if you can post to chat or to the task force members, the update to the Washington subset list. But again, that's the structural issue that we're faced with right now, which is that USCDI calls for the OMB list, which is very, very small, allows for a much more expansive list. It would probably be not a good idea if every jurisdiction established a slightly different subset list for race ethnicity, that picked from the CDC list. It would be useful if there was a nationwide floor that was, you know, more expansive than the OMB list, but actually useful for tracking tracking disease burden, disproportionate impact, and serving a public health response needs. Okay, as we go through, so I see a couple of more comments on race and ethnicity. Appreciate the updates. Again, that feels like a useful thing to contemplate. Are there other common topics that people have put in that they want to discuss in the next 5 minutes? And then at some point we need to transition to public comment. All right. Maybe then we, unless there's anything else that task force members want to comment on, maybe we should transition to public comment.
Before we do that, I just want to, I had my 5 minutes of rumination.
Awesome.
Provide a few sort of thoughts about the discussion today, which I thought was incredibly diverse and useful. And I think, you know, one of the things that I'm really hearing is that there is an opportunity for maybe perhaps tightenings of the standards within ECR versus in adoption. You know, I think that there is common agreement within public health for what the ECR standard is, both in terms of transport and in terms of the data elements that we would like to be reported to us. So I think that there's an opportunity there to discuss meaningful certification. And I think that, you know, there's something to consider is that, you know, which there is precedence for this, is perhaps considering a phased approach to certification as ECR matures. Maybe, you know, we should consider strengthening or tightening certification requirements over time. So just wanted to put that out there for people to think about.
Yeah, and Jillian, my biggest observation out of this is that ECR is only as good as the data in the EHRs that drive the triggers. And so being thoughtful about vocabulary in practice is making sure that we're upgrading USCDI and upgrading associated vocabularies, and being thoughtful about data flows that capture the source vocabulary that hit the triggers is going to be critical to make the investment in ECR actually work.
Couldn't agree more.
Maybe we should do a quick preview of coming attractions.
I think Joe has his hand up if you.
Okay.
Yeah, just the ECR development that's gone on has primarily been at the state level. There have been some cities involved, but there's a lot of local health departments that are not involved. So when we talk about public health, you know, coming together on a certain standard, there's still a lot of stakeholders that need to be at the table. And if we're talking about certifying systems, are we just talking about certifying state systems? Are we talking about getting it down to the local level? You know, I was in Indianapolis. I was director of Indianapolis. We did not, there's, you know, we don't have a system that would be certified by this, although we do a lot of work with ECR, and we have a lot of struggles getting data now in a population level around ECR with the state. I mean, there's always challenges getting data back and forth between locals and states.
Yeah.
So just to bring that up.
That's right. So by and large, when we're talking about certification, we're talking about certifying systems. And then the way this often works, at least has worked on the CMS side, is that ONC establishes certification criteria for systems. Those certification criteria are voluntary. And then CMS, in this case, establishes programmatic requirements for participation in a variety of CMS programs and ties certification requirements to those programmatics. One could imagine that the national infrastructure for where certification would tie in is that CDC, for example, would establish programmatic requirements, programmatics, funding opportunities, and other kinds of policy goals and then tie certification criteria, a use of certified systems to those programmatics, which is why, you know, I noted that these are going to be voluntary. There will be ways for local jurisdictions to not participate. There may well be funding ties as you contemplate how all this works. There may be funding ties that require certification. So, you know, the exact mechanism of how a local jurisdiction uses a certified system will likely be tied to whatever programmatic CDC chooses to attach a certification to. But we do have to go to public comment.
All right, thanks, Arianne. We're going to open up our meeting for public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand, and press once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause for a moment to see if anyone raises their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, Arianne and Jillian, so I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Awesome. Can we just go look at our preview of coming attractions? Where we are relative to the calendar. Jillian, remind me. I think our next hearing is on is either on lab or
electronic laboratory reporting.
Yeah. So be prepared for another thought-provoking and engaging and incredibly challenging and informative presentation on where we are with lab. This challenge is not getting easier. A plea for, and so fantastic uptake of the use of the spreadsheet, a plea when you draft proposed recommendations to follow the rubric of we recommend that ONC do blah, because it is very easy to establish recommendations. It's much harder to have recommendations to ONC that ONC do something. And you'll see that I've provided some template examples in the draft recommendations that I've done, but really appreciate all of the work to engage in the spreadsheet. And this will be the material that we'll use to turn into our final recommendations text.
Arianne, can you address Jim St. Clair's question regarding meetings that's in the chat? Or Mike?
Which comment?
I believe this is the last public meeting is Jim St. Clair's comment.
No, it's not. All of our meetings are public. We're following federal advisory rules for all of our meetings. And you know, as you can see, this whole series lines up till our final recommendations for the high tech.
And Arianne, I see that Jim has raised his hand. So Jim, if you would like to go, you have 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you. I was just following up on that, and I'm always happy to admit that I'm just doing something wrong. But in looking at the schedule as it is on the ONC website, this was available for registration. Maybe as the next meeting goes closer, they'll open it up for public registration, but it just didn't appear that way as it's currently listed.
Right. The registration links are posted 1 week in advance of each meeting. So if you log on after basically each task force meeting, then the next meeting will be up.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the guidance.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, with that, we will close this meeting. Again, just a plea to go into the spreadsheet and get the recommendation juices and observations flowing. We've made tremendous progress in just 3 meetings. Fortunately, we have a lot more work to go.
Thank you, everyone. Great.
Thanks, everybody.